Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey, what's up? This is Oren. Before we get into our episode, we wanted to tell you a little bit about our friend Jordan Brady's upcoming commercial directing boot camp.
It's on August 25th, and he teaches everything you need to know about making it in the commercial biz. Jordan's directed thousands of TV commercials and has his own production company that constantly churns out amazing spots, so he knows what he is talking about.
Now, there are only a few spots left for the August 25th session, but there is a 10% discount for listeners of Just Shoot It if you enter the code JSI when you register at commercialdirectingbootcamp.com.
We've heard awesome stuff from our friends who've taken the class, so if you were in Los Angeles and you were looking to launch your commercial career, Jordan Brady will help you out. Go to commercialdirectingbootcamp.com. Offer code JSI saves you 10%. Welcome to the 122nd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and this episode is brought to you by patrons Alex Griboskis and Shane Collins. Today we have Augustine Frizzell on the podcast. She is a writer-director. She had a movie premiere at Sundance, and now it is being released by A24.
I think it comes out the day after this podcast drops.
Yeah, so check it out. Never Going Back. It's on the A24 website. It's opening in LA and New York and then expanding to the rest of the country. And it's awesome. It's about these two high school dropouts that are totally insane. And you will enjoy it if you check it out. So we're going to talk to Augustine about that. She also just directed a pilot for HBO. She's kind of on fire.
She's blowing up. And she has a really tremendous story about coming to filmmaking and the process of making Never Going Back. She really is honest and frank about the whole development process and about how it was a long road to get to this film and how there were a lot of false starts along the way that I think everyone will be able to relate to.
Before we get to Augustine, I would love to find out, what have you been working on lately?
I just got back from Comic-Con.
Yawn.
Oh, man.
Comic-Yawn.
Comic-Yawn.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure, fair enough.
Isn't it weird how I want to direct Marvel movies and you couldn't give two shits about it, but I don't really care about Comic-Con and you love it?
Yeah, except for that I don't think I stepped foot in the Marvel booth. The thing that's special to me about Comic-Con is that you get to meet a lot of small publishers and the artists who are writing and drawing those books. And I certainly love plenty of the Marvel and DC artists, but the lines are hella long. So like you get to have like a real conversation with somebody and wait in line for like maybe 2 or 3 minutes and talk to somebody who's like just starting out or like has made this labor of love. And it's kind of this interesting, intimate sort of situation where they're just kind of there, you know, typically they'll like sketch something for you as they're signing the book, you know?
Oh, that's cool.
It's really cool. So those are the experiences that I'm after. The real thing I wanted to talk to you about, Oren, is that I really, you know, I've been going to this convention for years and I have loved going to film festivals. And this year in particular, I had a real hard time deciding whether or not I was going to go and for how many days and all that stuff. Because there is actual business that I do there, you get to see a lot of old contacts, and I was really having a hard time deciding if it was valuable to me professionally, regardless of whether or not I was going to have a good time. And so I wanted to ask you, how do you decide whether or not you attend a festival or a convention? When is it worth it to you to go to one of those?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, there are certain people that like love being in that chaos. And I feel like I used to be a person like that. And now I just, I mean, just the thought of paying like $30 to park somewhere, like could keep me away from, I would like not go to my own wedding if I had to pay $30 to park there, you know, like that's how much of a turnoff it is.
Yeah. It is hard to not have a hotel downtown. It makes it pretty darn hard.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, a festival, if I was invited and I could go, I would go. Yeah. There's a lot of people have this philosophy that I'm only going to go to a film festival when my movie gets in there. How many people do you know that have like never been to Sundance and they're like, I'll go when I have a movie there?
I mean, honestly, I had that opinion up until the conversation we had with Augustine later
today, yeah,
on this very episode. I think she really makes a strong point towards why you should go to festivals even if you don't have something showing.
Yeah, no, so we're not going to spoil it. But yeah, we do get a lot of insight on that. But I do find, you know, as we kind of have our like peaks and valleys in our career, the various aspects that we are, you know, kind of invested in, like there was a time when I would go to like every single screening I could. And then there was a time where I didn't feel like going to any screenings. And now I think I'm kind of really invested in going to more things, not just for networking, but just to be inspired and to just remember, you know, just for fun.
You have an excuse to see 3 movies in a day. That's pretty dope.
Well, before we get into the interview, I did want to mention that the one interesting thing I'm doing right now is Matt and I are talking about shooting a spec commercial together.
Mm-hmm. Actively doing it, actually.
Yeah, we still have to land on the date.
Sure, but, you know, we're having meetings and, like, the production company, it's not like, oh, we're thinking about it. Like, we're doing it.
Yeah, we're doing it. Look, when you're a working director and you get paid to direct, sometimes when you want to do your own thing, like you want to make your short film or you want to write your feature or you want to do anything, and just the inkling of a paid gig comes up, it'll like throw a wrench into all of that. So kind of my idea was like, if I get Matt on board, if I'm like beholden to someone else that's also relying on this shoot date, it'll be important enough for me to say like, hey, I know there's a gig that day, but I'm already booked. I'm sorry.
I don't know if we'll ever be in a position where we'll be like, no, I'm going to pass over paid work to do spec work. I think there's a reality where like you're not making a ton of money on your feature or even a short or something like that, where you would have to turn things down. But a spec commercial is a specific sort of thing where you're making it not only because you really like it, but because it's meant to get you more work. So it makes less sense to turn down paid work to do it.
Yeah, I guess I would wholeheartedly disagree.
Oh, good.
Because I think, like, so for me, making a spec commercial, and this is a little thing I just want to talk a short little bit about, is the David, who's the main executive producer at the production company I'm with, he says, let's look at your reel right now. And he asks, you know, the people in the office, okay, when Oren is up for a job, which 3 spots that he's directed do we show? And so we go, okay, well, it's the Converse one, and it's the NVIDIA one, and it's Time Warner one, let's say, or Jeep or whatever. And they're like, okay, well, if we replaced one of those, which one would we replace, and what would we replace it with that would get him a better chance to book this gig? So that's how they approach it. They're not really like, what would be the most fun to shoot or what's like the most in your voice, but
sure,
much more exactly what you're saying. Like, let's invest some resources into this thing to get us the bigger job. And so, yes, of course, if like,
so it does make sense to turn down the crappy job. Yeah,
but if you're like, hey, we want to shoot an interview for an industrial, it's going to pay $500 to go to this place, you know, then yeah, no, I think it's worth turning that down. But it's hard for us to turn down paid gigs just because we are freelancers, you know.
Yeah, it's a difference between like neuroses and need. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. We should turn them down, but we hate saying no to a job offer.
I think that there are plenty of circumstances or situations where you and I are both have had tremendous years where we are doing better financially than we've ever done, and a job comes in that we are not excited for that doesn't pay great. We're still going to bend over backwards to do.
Yeah. I had a phase when I was like, hey, if it's unscripted, don't put me up for it. Like, I have zero interest in unscripted stuff, even though it's super popular. Yeah. I think it's probably on, at least digitally, like the most popular genres, real people doing real things and saying real things.
And it's also hard to find people who can really deliver unscripted in a, because it's soft scripted is the thing.
Right, right.
Like you really, like someone who can write on the fly and like put words into talent's mouth as though it were their own thought.
Yeah. Like pushing people, encouraging people, mm-hmm. setting up environments. Anyway.
Asking the right question, phrasing it in a certain way so that they use the exact sentence that you just said to them.
Yeah. But today I would probably entertain some unscripted stuff because there's some really good unscripted things. Our friends just did this Mitsubishi commercial, which was, again, it was like this guy that does rapping on the fly. So it was unscripted and he's like giving people a test drive and then rapping to them about the features of the car. And now it's on TV like all the time, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, I think Oren from 2 years ago would have always turned that down. But now I'm just trying to be more open to finding the fun in like every job as opposed to like, I only want to direct this very specific type of thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think also there's the time commitment, you know,
right.
Like if you're doing 2 weeks of an unscripted thing and you get to do some, you know, fun camera stuff and stretch yourself in other ways, that's different than like 4 months of unscripted. Maybe
right.
Hurt your soul a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. But so the takeaway, I think, just about like working on this thing with Matt is like, if you do find yourself having trouble, I mean, we've gotten listener questions about this where it's like, I really want to make a film, but I just like can't get myself to do it because I've got jobs, I've got family, I've got all these other things. By the way, Augustine Frizzell, our guest today, has had a child when she was very young, and despite that, like went and took acting classes, made movies, had a side job, had like everything. Like, you know, I think it's just super inspirational to know like those excuses aren't valid.
Yeah.
But if you are having trouble, team up with someone. And to me, it's like I want to direct, and that's really important to me to direct. But also, I don't mind co-directing. I don't mind collaborating. I don't like. As long as you find someone that can overlap with you tonally on the project you're working right. with, I think go for it. Make something with someone. Doesn't like the titles don't matter.
Right. Go for it.
And right before we talk to Augustine, I'd like to remind everyone that we have a Patreon. The URL is patreon.com/justshootitpod. And it is a way that if you are a listener, if you're a fan, if you like this podcast and feel like you would like to support us or help, you know, us pay our editors, help us do more live events, which we are planning one for the end of the summer. Check it out. You know, it helps us and we would appreciate it. And we're also sending out monthly newsletters to our patrons.
Also, I think we're talking about some kind of exclusive perks for the live show.
Yeah.
So if you're an Angelino and you listen to the show and you've got an extra dollar a month, consider throwing that in so that you can help us make these live events happen.
Well, great. Let's get into it with Augustine. Augustine, how's it going? Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. It's going good.
So you just made Never Going Back.
I did. Well, I made it like a year ago.
Oh, congratulations.
All right, it's coming out.
Yeah, when is it coming out?
It comes out this Friday, August 3rd in LA and New York, and then it opens wider the following week and then the week after.
Awesome.
And where is it coming? Like, you can go to your local theater?
Wider? Yeah, I think so. I think we have like Washington, Dallas, Austin, Chicago, Seattle. There's like the major markets and then we'll hit some of the smaller ones the week after.
Awesome.
And I mean, my goal is that we get into some small towns simply because the movie takes place in a suburb.
Yeah. And tell us, what's kind of the log line for this movie?
Can I try?
Ooh.
The log line.
Yeah. All right. Oren, go for it.
I saw the movie a few nights ago. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what I think the log line is. Two sexually fluid high school dropouts dream of getting away from their small town suburban life and going to the beach.
That sounds about right. That's exactly right.
But since they have an inability to stay out of trouble, things go awry quickly, and at every next step they take a turn that you wouldn't expect.
That's just about right. you might expect some, but
meeting these girls, you're like, they're gonna get into some trouble.
Yeah, we see it coming.
There is one scene where they're like, okay, there's a ton of drugs here, but we're not gonna do any of this. Mm-hmm. And go.
And they succeed. Like, they don't, you know, they don't do any intentionally. So you gotta give them that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they actually don't do any.
But you know drugs are going to be
You know it's gonna accidentally happen.
That's like going to, like, wild rivers and being like, I'm not gonna get wet.
You know? Right. Yeah. I'm just gonna land.
And then you walk by a slide and someone splashes.
Yeah, that is true.
So what's your version of the logline?
No, I think you got it. I think, let's see. God, I've written it a lot of times. So, 16-year-old best friend's high school dropouts who work at a diner in small town or in a city in Texas. They just want to get away from their sad lives for weekends by going to the beach, and they blow their rent money on that trip, and then they have to figure out a way to get it back after they're fired. Something like that.
And it's kind of, even though there's like a lot of plot, it kind of feels like slice of life-y a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like you're kind of just hanging out with these girls. Kind of reminded me a little bit of like 13. Even though I haven't seen that movie in like
13 years.
Yeah, like 20 years. Whenever, I don't know.
13's like the really dramatic version of my movie.
Yeah, yeah.
My movie's like poop jokes and stoners.
Yeah, it's much more fun.
Oh, yeah. And Kyle Mooney is
in Kyle Mooney. Yeah, so, he's hilarious.
Yeah, that's awesome. Was that, and when you worked with him, he was already on SNL, right?
He was. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, so tell us how did this movie come to be? What was its origin story?
So it's based on my real life, and the majority of the stuff in the movie actually happened to me, sadly. So I had written about it time and time again, or told stories from my youth time and time again, and then
including the beach story and everything.
The beach story was like wanting to go to the beach. We wanted to move to Santa Cruz, California, to be honest, and so we had this idea that that's where everything was happening. There were like surfers, and there was this college, and
you were in Texas.
I was in Texas, yeah, and I was a big fan of the Lost Boys, and they moved to the Santa Clarita, or not Santa Clarita, Santa, what's it called? I can't even remember at this point. So in my mind, that's what Santa Cruz was. It was like this really cool place, and maybe you meet vampires, maybe you just meet like the two Corys, you know.
I've spent some time in Santa Cruz. It's not that far off.
Yeah. Really? Okay.
I mean, it's really, they're still playing hacky sack right now, I guarantee.
Amazing.
It. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. They like I mean, it wasn't that long ago when they would like throw acid on the windows of Starbucks because it was like too corporate.
Oh, yeah, totally. Are you serious?
And I'm like, guys, if you're gonna let one corporate company in here, I think Starbucks
is
okay.
It is like, it's the perfect merger of like hippy dippy and like surf skate culture.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds like, great. Right, see, that's what I was hoping for. Yeah. It sounded amazing, but we never made it. But we did go to the beach in Texas on a few times, and those were really great memories. I mean, the beaches are like mostly pretty gross. They're, you know, oil spills have affected the cleanliness. With water, and there's like a ton of mosquitoes, but we had such a fun time just getting away from the humdrum reality of our lives.
Got it. So then you're kind of like this wayward teenager growing up, you're collecting all these incredible stories. Mm-hmm. How do you get into filmmaking? Like, what drew you to filmmaking?
So I'd always wanted to be a singer. My dad's side of the family were singers, and I always thought I'd do that. I always loved singing, but I have really terrible stage fright, so I was never able to get past that and like develop the confidence and courage to get on stage. And so at one point I took an acting class thinking that might help with stage fright. And at this point, I'd had a daughter. I got pregnant early. I was 18 when I got pregnant and had her when I was 19. And she was like 2 or 3, and I took an acting class and just felt alive in this weird way. I thought there was that moment that happens when you get in the zone, you know, and you're not paying attention to anything. Your mind kind of empties, and it was a really interesting feeling. And so I was doing that, and then my teacher asked me to audition for this murder mystery dinner theater trip that he hosted.
And you're still in Texas?
At this point, yeah. And so I auditioned and got the job and started doing that. And that kind of led to working, like doing short films. I joined this Yahoo group called Dallas filmmakers or something like that and joined the Yahoo group. And that's actually how I met my husband, David, who's a filmmaker as well. I auditioned for the short film. It was like my third audition ever. It was a movie called Still, and that was David's short film, and he cast me. And so we ended up meeting like that.
Wow, yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah, that was back in 2001. That was a long time ago.
And so did you have like a day job while you were doing the acting?
Yeah, I was waitressing at that point. Yeah, so I was waitressing, but then doing a ton of other stuff. I, over the years, did alcohol promotions and toilet paper promotions. And, like, you know, just like any, I would work stadiums. I would, like, do all this crazy stuff, any sort of odd jobs and side jobs that I could find to put money together that maximized my hours the best as they could. So, like, the fewest hours, most money I could make so that I could also take care of my daughter and kind of do acting in the evenings. And the murder mystery thing paid, so that was great. But then over the years, I just started doing more film and started wanting to be on set and noticed that it wasn't exactly – I didn't connect as much with the other actors as like on a friend basis, but I connected with filmmakers just because I loved movies so much. And so I started finding that that was kind of my group. And then, you know, I married, like my husband and I, we were together back in 2001, weren't together for 8 years, and then reacquainted in 2009.
Wait, so you had dated in 2001?
Briefly.
And briefly parted ways.
Uh-huh.
And then years later, rediscovered each other?
Yeah, he wrote me randomly, and he'd said he had a dream about me and wanted to get in touch with me. And I'd
this
always.
Is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd always. Like that first time that we were together, it was so magical and like this really intense thing. And but then it just didn't work out. Wasn't the right time.
Did you like the short film? Like, was that creatively satisfying?
Being in Still? Yeah, it was really fun. It was also just, I think of acting as the most miserable thing I could possibly be doing, but also really fun and interesting. I don't know. It's terrifying, but I'm really self-aware. And so I can't get into it. It's just like this whole mind fucks. Like it's hard for me. So it was fun, but
stressful.
It's always stressful. Yeah. Anyway. So yeah, we reacquainted in 2009 and then ended up, you know, getting together, got married a year later. And during that time, he knew that I'd been writing and that I had kind of an interest in making stuff. And over the years I'd been homeschooling my daughter and she and I had been making these little, like, you know, mini DV films on, iMovie and, you know, just stuff, but I never considered it filmmaking. I never even thought of it in that on those terms. I was homeschooling her and it was kind of just like this thing that we did.
Yeah, like it's a way to do projects together and it's fun and different.
Yeah,
than,
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so fascinating.
Sorry, I'm only interrupting because I have a daughter and I've been talking to Matt about whether I should like make movies with her.
Yeah.
Because I want her to be like Alina Dunham, or, you know?
Right.
So her, if her
your
career
question
can take
is
off.
Like, oh, should I imbue her with everything I've learned?
How old is she?
She's 2.5.
Oh, yeah. Now's the time. Yeah, don't let this slip past you.
Yeah.
Well,
no, you should.
But so through homeschooling, is there? Do they say you have to do a certain like amount of art projects or something? Like,
no, my daughter was actually unschooled, and so that's a completely it's a pretty different thing than homeschooling in that we did not use any sort of government mandated curriculum. We actually used very few traditional methods of schooling. We used real books, and she would just have an interest. We go to the library and read stuff. It's child-led learning, so you follow their path, and
I see.
And you kind of help let them like figure out what they want to do.
So there's no pie chart of like, well, okay, it's art time now. Gotcha.
No. So so we just do whatever she felt like and what I felt like teaching her, and did that for years. And then she eventually did like an online school, but. So there was like this festival or a conference every year, an unschooling conference. And I remember going 1 year and they had a editing workshop where they taught you Final Cut Pro. And I went in there and just stayed for days, like the entire time. Yeah. And the kids were free to like run around and do their thing. And so I was just in there editing. And then we made this film with the equipment that they had. And I directed all the kids. It was called Booktopia. Yeah. Like, we wrote it together with the kids. And I just remember like maybe being a little more controlling with the scripts than I should have been, like a group of kids. Like, we need to make this cohesive. Like,
you fired seven kids that day.
Exactly.
That's right.
It was a cast of three.
We actually had some like not committed, and me and the guy that was, he and I were kind of working on it together. He was another parent. We were like, we got to let him go. Like, if they can't show up, they can't get here. They don't understand. Like, we can't shoot half the movie without
Welcome to the real world, kids.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, I learned editing. And then at one point, I was so nervous to talk to my husband about it, but I had this idea and I was like, I've really been thinking about maybe kind of making a short film. And
your husband's a director.
He's a director. Yeah. And so he was super supportive. He said, yeah, you should do it. And I said, but we don't have any money. And like, how do you do it? And he just explained, you know, write a script, because it was more of just an idea and a story I'd written and not in script form. He was like, well, write a script and then send it out. And you've been volunteering for years in other people's films, which I had. I'd been working in any department I could be in and just getting on set and thanking them for letting me come and like do work on their things. And so he was like, just do the same thing. Like, ask people if they want to come and help. And it turns out they do.
Yeah.
And so,
especially when you've been helping them for so long.
Yeah.
Cash those favors in. That's awesome.
Yeah, so that was it.
So that was Never Going Back?
No. That was the first short that I made. That was called Clean. That was like in 2012 or something. Maybe 2013. I don't remember the date. And then made that, was just on fire. Like, I can't believe I just made my first movie. It was like a one-day shoot, and it was so exciting, and I just felt so alive. And it was the best process. And then I edited it, and liked it pretty well, submitted to a couple festivals, didn't get in, and I was like, okay, that's okay, I'm gonna move on to the next thing and like let it just rest. So it's somewhere online, but made some shorts and then attempted making this movie in 2014 for the first time, which failed. We actually shot it in 16 days with like a $30,000 budget. I'd received a grant from the Austin Film Society, used that money along with a crowdfunding campaign, and shot it for no money.
Wait, so hold on.
Okay.
So you wrote so you made some shorts, you had like a little bit of success, but you weren't, I mean, I think like something awesome is a lot of people will like make one short, put their whole heart and soul into it, and it doesn't get into Sundance or something, and then they're just like,
and then it's
forget it.
Filmmaking's not for me.
Really?
But the fact that you're just like, oh well, who cares? Let's go on to the next one.
Next one. Yeah.
That's like what we try to encourage. Well, even though we're just as guilty of it.
Yeah, sure. You know,
everyone gets bummed.
Yeah, there's pluses and minuses to that. I wonder about that too, because I was just talking to my husband about this whole process of a movie being released and what that feels like and how it's exciting. But honestly, thanks A24 for like buying my film and putting it out. I want people to see it for sure. That's the goal. But at the same time, there's a part of me that's just like, I could just make it and put it away and just go on and make the next one. No one would ever have to see it. There's something so pleasant and fulfilling about just the making of the thing and being, you know, creating it and then being on set and then editing it. And I really could just edit it and put it in my hard drive and be done. It's so weird. I don't know if that's how everyone feels.
No, I definitely.
Really? Is, okay.
You think that is how everyone feels?
That's how I feel.
Oh, sure. Really?
Yeah.
You don't care about validation or like people telling you you're good or making more money to make a bigger movie?
The money part for sure.
Yeah, the money part's great. Yeah.
But like, you know, I do a lot of like sketch comedy and stuff. So like I post that stuff all on the internet. And so like at a certain point, all of those numbers just don't mean anything.
They don't.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
they don't mean
anything. It's like, okay.
Right.
Like,
well, the viral videos is different. It's like, that's like being on drugs, I think. Right. Because it's like, you're like so exciting.
I call it like the refreshies.
All these comments at one time. And it's like, I think they've done a ton of studies. It's like, you know, being on cocaine or something. But for like those few days, and then it goes away. And it's like, as if you never made that video. But the movie.
But then with the drug metaphor, like it takes more and more to get that same buzz. So it's like, oh, great. 100,000 views. Big whoop.
I would need a million. 100,000 views isn't cool. Yeah, a million views is cool.
You know what's cool?
When I made my first movie, it was at a festival and I had a little theatrical release and stuff. And my boss at the time, who had made a bunch of movies, I worked at Disney, but he had produced all these things independently, was like, dude, Oren, this is like you, because I was like so worried about what the next step is and how much money it's going to make and what theaters and how, are the investors going to make their money back. And he was like, dude, just stop thinking of all of that. Like, this is probably the most fun of the movie, really. Like, just the time in the movie is coming out. Yeah, like enjoy it. Like go to the festivals and just like relax and
just
talk
like
to people.
Hang out at a podcast.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But he was really into like focus on having fun now because it's going to get stressful whether it does well or doesn't do well.
Yes.
But if it doesn't do well, then at least you were having
fun. In the meantime, I know. When it was released. Twice. Yeah. Know? Yeah.
So I don't know. I like releasing stuff and showing it to people and getting feedback. And
It's great. It's simultaneously the most exciting part and the most hellacious part. It's terrifying and like stress ridden, and you're wondering what people are going to think. And then they're thinking things that you just never thought they'd think. And a lot of people are thinking things. You're like, oh yeah, I kind of figured they might think that. And it's like that. And then there's like the good responses where you're like, okay, yeah, this is why I did it. It's really fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's hard to let that good response outweigh the like one guy on Twitter who's like 100 followers and he's like, meh.
Yeah.
Like this.
Well, to me, the worst is like when you feel like there's a problem with your movie but everyone else seems to love the movie and you're like, oh, it's good. I was wrong. And then like,
and then one person,
one guy's like, I see that problem.
Yeah. Why would they go like, to that party?
You were right. I knew better.
I knew it. Yeah. Someone finally saw my flaws.
Yeah. That's much worse than like the surprise one, you know, like, oh, like, cause it's easier to dismiss something that feels so far out of left field, you know, but like when you secretly know they're right, that's when it's the worst.
But also, you know, like if you don't get any insults, you know, the movie has not gone mainstream. It hasn't gone wide.
Yeah.
You have to get the negative comments to realize like people are watching that don't know you.
Right? That's true. And also it's better to be a little bit, you know, people should be a little bit divided about how they feel about your film.
Absolutely.
And I look at all the films that I love the most and they all have.
Yeah. My parents
haters.
Hate them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, I mean, I'm a this thing about like the drug feeling of like checking your views. Mm-hmm. I have that with like checking the statistics on IMDb and
who's watching? I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that many right now. It's just over 100, but still I'm like, what is this breakdown looking like? And it's like men over the age of 45 have voted it. Like they hate it.
Oh man.
Really?
Let me tell you, never release a video on YouTube.
Really?
Like the stats are so like acute and specific. Like you can see when they stopped watching things, how many people stopped watching to a certain point, all sorts of geographic demographics.
Oh yeah. That's they like have that nightmare. On Vimeo too.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's also
thing.
A nightmare.
Oh man.
I know. You're like, 20 people saw my reel today. Three of them watched it the whole the past halfway.
It's painful. It's so painful. Brutal.
Well, I want to get back to you made Never Going Back two times. So let's talk about that first time. That's really fascinating. So you were saying basically that you didn't have enough money to do it right the first time, or walk us through that whole process.
So I'll try and sum this up as fast as I can. So I made the shorts, I made that very first short, which I'd never released. And then I made three other shorts over the course of a weekend. They were just like short. Well, I'd started out with one and it was a little long, and then we got access to an Alexa and I was like, okay, we should just do three.
I hear you.
Yeah, that's Matt's theory.
That is my problem. I'm like, oh, what?
I'm like, why don't we best of our time and crew and like just go for it.
Yeah. What about making one perfect thing?
I don't have that drive. I mean, but at the same time, you'll tell my story and you'd be like, yeah, she's a fucking perfectionist. Like that's not the case. Anyway, so I'd made this short. It got into South by Southwest. Played really well, had good response, and I was just like pumped up. I was like, I need to make something else. And I'd written another short that I loved. It was the script's probably somewhere, but I just thought I was so driven and wanted to do it. And I applied for a grant, started the process of a grant, which if you've ever done is a long and drawn out process. There's a lot to fill out and there's a lot, you have to do a budget, like do this whole thing. So I started the process for the grant, wanting to make this short film next. And in the meantime, the trailer for A Light Between Oceans, do you know this film? It's got Rachel Weisz and who else? Alicia, the Tomb Raider, the new Tomb Raider.
Vikander.
Yeah. So it's got them and Fassbender. And so they find a baby washed up on the shore.
Oh, yes. I do know this movie.
Point is, it was the exact premise of my short film. My short film was about this couple that finds a baby washed up on shore and the woman takes it and it causes like some issues. So anyway, that was my short that I wanted to make. And as soon as this trailer came out, I was like, what the fuck? Like, this is the thing I was going to do. Like, I can't do it now. I've spent all this time. I just can't go forward with this. It's going to look like I copied this movie. So I'd already gone through all the trouble of the grant, and the application deadline was nearing, like probably in like 2 days or something. And so I had a really rough draft, incomplete, of Never Going Back. And I knew the basic idea, what I wanted to do. And so I was just like, fuck it, I'm going to apply with this. Yeah, yeah. I'll make my first feature.
Was it the same like genre and tone?
It was, yeah, very similar. It was about the two girls, Jessie and Angela. And a lot of, well, there are a few scenes that came directly from the first version into the one that you've seen. Uh-huh. But a lot of it was changed. I mean, very, very much changed. But a lot of the characters were still in there. Dustin and Ryan were in there, Tony, and you know, all this stuff. So I applied for the grant, and then I got the grant. And in that period of time, my husband was having to leave to go to New Zealand for 6 months to shoot Pete's Dragon. Mm-hmm. And so I was going to go with him, and that deadline was approaching. So I was like, shit, if I don't make this before we leave, we're going to be gone for 6 months.
Right.
I'm not going to get it made. I just got this grant. Like, what do I do?
And had you already crowdfunded at that point?
Not yet. No, not yet. So I knew the money, you know, the grant money. Maybe we had started pushing forward on the idea of a crowdfund, but I don't think so, because we were crowdfunding until like the shoot was starting.
Like, how much were you, like, money did you want?
I don't remember. 15,000, something like that. I don't.
So you were going to do the whole feature for like under 50.
We were doing, yeah, we ended up making it for 30,000, right around 30,000. So we put some additional funds on top of the grant and the crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. So we put in some of our own money and made, you know, that round out the budget. So.
And did you shoot on Alexa with like a crew?
We did shoot on Alexa. Yeah. Well, one of my friends, my producer, Liz Cardenas, they own an Alexa. Mm-hmm. And so she was able to let us use it for the shoot. And then we had a bunch of people just helping out.
Pitching in.
And I was stopping at fucking Taco Cabana every morning for breakfast tacos for everyone. Like, it was a hard shoot.
So Texan.
Everything came from thrift stores. Yeah. Like, it was intense. So we shot it in 16 days. I finished it, and 2 weeks later left for New Zealand. And so,
how did the shoot go?
It was hard and unfun. Yeah. It was.
What made it unfun? Can you talk about that a little bit?
I can talk about that a little bit.
How about a better question, actually?
What did you learn?
Yeah, what did you learn? Or like, because I think a lot of our listeners are thinking about, like, yeah, okay, $50,000 micro budget feature. $30,000 micro budget feature. I get that. Like, so yeah. What made it hard was
my advice is to hire, or if you're not hiring, people are just working for free, people who you instinctually know are good people, number mm-hmm. one, and number two, who respect your vision and are on the same page with you about what you want to do, especially key positions like your director of photography. They should be someone that you get along with mm-hmm. and that will accept and appreciate your vision and help you achieve it and not belittle you and make you feel like shit.
Can I ask you, I mean, that sounds super valuable. Can I ask you like what you did to share your vision with like the crew? Did you like make like show them references or
storyboard? Shot listing and discussing and like really planning out like this is what I had in mind and like describing the shots and you know all this type of thing and being like what were you thinking and mm-hmm. like asking for like a dialogue and saying, hey, this is kind of how I want it to look, like there's this film that I just love and this is kind of the color tone and whatever. So just references, I mean, mm-hmm. And then hoping, and for me, because I'd never done anything, a lot of that was also about figuring it out when you're there.
Right.
And saying, I don't know exactly what I'm doing, which I always say because I'm still figuring
this
out. Even
though you already had like a short at South By at this point and got a government grant.
Yeah, but but you still, even now, I still don't know everything because I come from such a micro budget world.
Right.
There's so much to learn. And so for me, a lot of that is figured out on set. Mm-hmm. Being like, okay, I have an idea about how I want things to go. I know we're doing this bit handheld, and this is kind of something I made in my last short. So I know that this is how we need to shoot it because this is what I learned making the short, mm-hmm. and this is how we need to cover it, and this is how it's going to cut together because I had edit experience at that point.
Right,
and
right,
so
right.
It's just stuff like that. Like, but still you're figuring it out. Mm-hmm. And so having the ability to say, hey, I don't know what I'm doing, but let's try this thing, and then not be made to feel bad about it.
Right.
Like, you should have a partner who's like, yeah, let's try it. Like, yeah. let's give it a go. Like, let's see what that would be. Or can say like, well, maybe, you know, in my experience, this might not be the thing, but maybe we could try blah, blah, blah. And then you have like a dialogue. You don't want someone who's like, no, stupid, dumb, right. you know,
yeah.
so you.
And you also yeah. don't want, I think, I've had experience where like the like key people and their entire team is like backing them up no matter what they say, right? So yeah, you not, it's not just you against one other person, it's you against them and everyone
right.
that
right.
they've brought on. Right?
Directing is so funny too, because like we spend so little time on set relative to every other position, right? So like a DP is like shooting nonstop, or a sound person shooting. Right. Like they're
and when
all
the first
like,
AD is like, that's going to take us 10 hours. Let's just do this and this. And you're
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Wow.
You're like, well,
but
hold
it's
on.
A different shot.
Yeah, let's have a conversation about it, right? And so, it's really frustrating to hear like it's very vulnerable to be able to say like I don't know exactly. Let's figure it out together, right? Mm-hmm. And the collaboration has to be. Everyone has to be down to do that, basically. And
yeah.
Getting bulldozed is like, I mean, it's happened to everybody and it's the worst.
It sucks and it's unfair because, especially in an environment like that, you're not having to answer to a studio. Mm-hmm. You're not having to pay anyone back. You don't owe any money. You're simply trying to make a thing and you want everyone to come at it with this mm-hmm. team spirit and supportive vibe. And that's how I like being on set. And I find it so pleasurable being on set. It's one of my favorite
sure,
places.
Yeah.
There's just nothing like it. And I'm so happy when I'm there. And you're happy when you're with your team. And I love working with actors. I fucking love working with actors. And so, and finding the shots and like figuring it out and, you know, discovering all these things, it's the best. And so when someone comes in with like a sour attitude, especially for a project like that, sure. we're not getting paid.
Yeah,
come
yeah.
in and have fun.
Yeah,
my like, God, let's just create together.
What are you doing
yeah,
here?
And why? Yeah.
That's really funny.
So, I also find like with directing specifically, like when all those people that have been working, you know, shooting 300 days a year or whatever are telling you that you're doing something the wrong way or there's a better way to do it. They're like taking you out of the equation.
Yeah,
for
the special the element.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
it's fine if you fail or you do something totally the wrong way and it looks like crap. But if it is great, you're like the only person doing it. You know?
Exactly.
And that's what makes you have
your
some sort of
vision.
A voice. Yeah.
Yes, completely. I agree.
Oh, wait. One last question. Is it the same cast in the first version
no,
of the movie?
Only two of the actors are the same.
Oh,
and
which
that's
ones?
Dustin and Ryan.
The brother and
his bougie friends.
Okay. Oh yeah. yeah. I like that character.
Yeah, he's great.
So the first pass didn't come out the way you wanted.
Correct.
Right.
Did you edit it and finish it and submit it to festivals and do
no.
all that stuff?
I got to New Zealand, started the edits, and like 3 weeks later, had a pretty good cut in the deadline for South by Southwest. Had you know, had made his way
right.
to
you were
me,
on New Zealand time, so it was
yeah.
like you were a week late.
So no, like the deadline was there, and I just remember I'd already written Janet and asked for an extension, and mm-hmm. she is the programmer of South
Man,
by Southwest.
Texan
by
filmmakers,
I know,
just saying what? Like, oh, I wrote Janet. That's like. But, like if I said, yeah, I just called Robert up and I was like, listen, bro.
Who's Robert?
Redford.
Oh, right. It's Sunday.
Or, yeah. Who runs TIFF?
I don't know. I'm out of names to drop. I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. If you want to delete that name drop, I didn't mean it that way. Like,
no.
She's the most personable
no.
and like supportive person you'd ever meet.
But I do think it's so charming and great. It's like yeah. the thing. It's like the superpower of Texan.
No, but it is. Worth noting that if you get a short into a festival, it's much easier for you
right.
to have access to the people
right.
yeah.
to ask for an extension or do something.
Absolutely.
Like
and I, you know, it's also my husband had a film there. And so he had a relationship with Janet. So mm-hmm. I'd known her over the years of going. I went to South by Southwest several years before
sure.
I ever even made a film.
Yeah.
And so I'd met all the programmers and had that relationship and, you know, met other filmmakers and stuff like that. So that
it's
was
a community
helpful
for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of,
yeah. Yeah.
I think
completely.
That we never really talked about this on the podcast before, but I think it's helpful to think about, like, if you're aiming for a festival, it's not a bad
oh,
idea
to go
to that festival before you apply.
Because, as many years as you can.
Yeah, because when I'm submitting my short film to South By and you're submitting yours,
yeah.
you know, and they're of equal value. Like, they know, like, you're always up against
totally.
People that have a relationship with the festival, no matter, like, what they tell you.
No, 100% you are. And it's something about, I thought about this a lot, too, in regards to, like, the actors that you cast. There's something about having a familiarity with people who you've seen mm-hmm. working towards a thing. And mm-hmm. so if you've known them for a while and you've seen the process and you're like, okay, they're committed.
You're
it's not just
going
to be like a yeah. one shot, like some dude make a thing and then he's back to his, you know, real life or she. You've seen the process. And so you're like rooting and being like, okay, I'm going to support this in the hopes that they continue on and use this support to build their career.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So there's that. So, yeah. So I went, didn't submit it. I wrote and I was like, hey, I think it's not ready. I don't want to send it through yet. I thought about doing reshoots if I were going to she was like super supportive. She was like, you don't understand like how many filmmakers I wish would do this. And, and I was like, I think I'm going to wait and send it next year. And so that was like this whole thought, like, do I go back to Dallas while I'm in New Zealand, having this crazy opportunity to be in New Zealand? Do I go back to Dallas, do a few reshoots and then stay and maybe get into the festival, maybe not get into the festival. And then I like miss this chance. And then also ultimately have a film that I don't love start to finish. There were so many things about it I disliked.
Yeah.
That even with reshoots, it wasn't like the thing I wanted to have myself known as for my first film. And so I wrote her. I was like, I don't think I'm going to submit it. I'm going to wait a year. And she was like, that's so smart. Like, I love that you're doing that.
Do you think that matters? Like your debut film, like what people think of it?
No, not at all. In fact, I mean, it doesn't, but it was a story that it's my personal, like your personal story.
Right.
Yeah. And so it doesn't matter, but then for me, it kind of did, I guess. I don't know why it mattered. It doesn't really. You should be able to make the thing and like let it be your first thing and then continue on. But for some reason, I just wanted to like start with a thing.
Right.
That may be a little bit of the other side of having a hometown festival that's on a national scale.
Right.
Like if all of your friends have been going to South by for years and years and years and you're premiering your movie that you don't completely love, that's hard to face people afterwards as well.
Yeah, especially when it's about you.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, I was a pretty mediocre actor when I was a teenager, so
yeah,
that's why this movie is not great. So you didn't remake the same movie with the same script. You kind of started fresh.
Yeah, so once I made that decision to hold off, I showed it to my husband's producers, who are also good friends. I'd known them for many years. And looking back, the people that had offered to help, and I should have let them help me make it instead of being like, no, I want to do it on my own and I don't want to use my husband's connections. And like, they're like, we're not your husband's connections. We're like two of your best friends. Like, just let us help you. And it's a really good idea. And so so they watched the rough cut and they were just like, man, this has a lot of potential. If you had a supportive team and you were to make the changes to the script that you've been talking about making, this could be a career starter. Like there's stuff here that's unique and you have a clear voice and it's like apparent throughout. And so,
but they agreed that it didn't hit its potential.
Oh, completely. Yeah. Yeah. They were like, this is, you know, Toby is, he's one of my producers. He's quoted, I think in the story, he's like, you've got like 15 minutes here that are like career starters and the rest you can throw it away. Like something like that.
And were your feelings hurt?
No, because I didn't like it either. And so I was just like, okay, like verified, this movie sucks. But the thing is like, it didn't complete, like I can look at it now and be like, okay, it didn't completely suck. It just wasn't what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And there were elements that were just so predictable. And they had the trope of the girls. There was this guy that they'd known and he comes around and it causes like jealousy. And then they get in this little fight and like it's that thing. And that was like the scene that I hated most. Right. And that whole little storyline. Yeah. I was like, I'm not doing that. We see it in every movie about friends and I don't want it to have that moment. So I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. And so
Don't you think a better commentary for your movie would be, like, on the Blu-ray, would be, like, you doing your commentary on the first version of the movie and talking about what wasn't working and what was working?
Yeah, well, that would actually be amazing.
I would buy that Blu-ray.
Really? Yeah, I should do that. I'll propose it.
I love that idea.
Because it's, like, how, like, you're talking about how this day was really sunny and we needed rain or whatever.
Right.
It's kind of interesting. But if you're, like, look how dumb this scene is. So I took this scene and this is how I fixed it. It'd be so much more interesting.
That's actually a great idea and helpful. I would watch that too.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So anyway, so I scrapped it. They were like, you should just remake the whole thing. And I thought, no, I could never do that. This was so hard. Like, blood, sweat, and tears went into this. And it's fucking difficult to make a movie for that much money. And I felt exhausted and, like, emotionally drained. And I was like, no, I can't do that. I'm just going to do the reshoots when we get home. And then the more I started thinking about, like, having that be my first thing and listening to my brave producer Toby being like, no one's waiting on this, like, you don't owe anybody a movie, you could just, like, set the whole thing aside, no one would ever know, make the script changes you want and we'll remake it, we'll get a new cast, we'll find money, we'll have, like, support, and, you know, you make the thing you want to make. And
so it was like a proof of concept, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, I don't know, I feel like such a failure, like, I'm completely, like, messed up and my first attempt is awful. And I was really depressed, to be honest. And they were like, you don't understand how many people would kill for this opportunity. How many first-time filmmakers would give anything to go back and have a trial run and then, like, redo it and, like, not have any consequences? And I was like, I guess you're right. Yeah, that is a good way to see it. And so I set it aside and I just left it there for a bit. And then I went and enjoyed New Zealand and came back, packed up our Dallas house. We moved to LA because David was in post-production here. And then I started on rewrites and, like, spent every day, like, rewriting. And I was teaching yoga at the time as far as jobs go and how you support yourself. So I had a job teaching yoga. And
what an ideal situation.
We've talked about this on the podcast before, but there's, like, a company that's, like, trying to change how movies are made, where they, like, will budget for, like, 20 days of shooting and then 10 days of reshooting and then a month of editing and then 10 days of reshooting, because every good indie film, I think, is made that way. Like,
I was talking about doing yoga and writing every day.
Well, that is also awesome, especially Matt recently did goat yoga.
Yeah. Oh, I want to go so bad.
Oh, you guys, it's so great.
I'm obsessed with goats. My fallback plan, if my career as a filmmaker doesn't come through, is to open a goat farm. It's going to be a goat sanctuary, and I'm going to have sheep and cats and dogs.
The other thing I want to talk about and think about a little bit is that it would be easy for plenty of people. We talked about, like, how many opportunities, like, a person would have to get discouraged and to, like, throw it all away and burn it all down and move on to something else, right? Mm-hmm. And how you stuck it and made a good movie that then got a release, and, like, you know, you did it right. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It would be so easy to just be like, how many screenplays have everyone started that they're like, this isn't good, and then just stopped there?
Yeah.
To have made the movie and then been like, this isn't good enough, I'm going to do it over again.
Yeah.
Is so baller. That's, like, the coolest shit I've ever heard.
It's kind of ridiculous, but yeah, it worked out well. I'm glad I did it.
Am I allowed to ask you how you got the money for the second time?
Yeah.
Because I can imagine approaching an investor and being like, yeah, I already tried this once and it didn't work. Can I try it again? Yeah.
Like, in startups, that's what they want, right? They want to know how to do it differently.
Well, what I'd done during the process of the rewrites, I decided to go ahead and cut some of the footage into a short film. Mm-hmm. And so I did a couple days of reshoots here in LA and added that footage to the initial footage. Mm-hmm. And it fit pretty well. Like, it was, you know, supposed to be in Garland, but it worked out well. And that got into South by Southwest too. Uh-huh. And then won some awards and, you know, did pretty well on the festival circuit. So I had that as a proof of concept to show people. And then I had the fortune to have amazing producers who had a good track record, Sailor Bear with Toby and James and David. And, you know, having that connection is really helpful when you need people to trust you in making your film. And so, Toby, he had just produced A Ghost Story, which is my husband's movie. Mm-hmm. And they had private investors to do that and made it for pennies. I mean, that's, like, a super inexpensive movie. And having just done that and having had the success of that as, you know, a template, mm-hmm. like, hey, look what we did with this much money. Look how it looks. Like, we want to do that with her movie, too. And so I, at that point, had finished the script and he was able to take it out with the script. And luckily, people responded to the script. Mm-hmm. And we had 5 private investors, 3 of whom had been on A Ghost Story, mm-hmm. and then 2 new ones. And they put in a very small amount of money each. And we made it with that.
That's awesome. And did you have the cast attached at that point?
No, we didn't have anyone attached at that point. We only had the script and we knew we wanted to do it. So I was also fortunate to have the money first and then to be able to go and look for actors because there were no, you know, there was no requirement to find like a name to get it financed. We had the money and the actors knew ahead of time, this is a no budget film. Like it's not going to be super fancy. Although they did get like good accommodations and you know, it's a really well oiled machine, what we can do in Texas for a small dollar amount.
Right.
Yeah.
And so,
and your lead, Maya Mitchell, is like blowing up.
Yeah.
The last person we had on this podcast, also through Sunshine Sex, Elijah, had Timothy Chalamet in his film, who was like nobody when he made that movie.
Right.
But I feel like Maya Mitchell is also in his film.
Yeah.
Hot Summer Nights. But,
and that's A24. Yeah,
but she's like, I feel like she's all over the place now. I just keep seeing her pop up. So
she's so talented. So talented. I was just amazed that she wanted to do it. And she was just like, yeah, I do the show. I've been on it for 5 years. And I happen to have this one tiny window. It's when you're shooting. I really want to do it.
Let's do it.
Well, I mean, she went through the whole process, like sent in her auditions and they were fantastic.
Oh,
like
cool.
Just nailed both roles. And I was like, she's just so good. Like, we have to have her.
And did she see the short? Or, like, what kind of first helped her fall in love with the
script? So, surprisingly, she had a... Well, I mean, it wasn't similar, but she knew that world. She's from Australia, and she's from a really small town in Australia. And so, like any small town, where no matter where it is, when you don't have access to like culture and art and, you know, all of these programs that bigger cities have, or like access to those things, you make your own fun. And she just told me the story about how for fun in high school they would put a mattress in the back of a pickup truck and like drive out to a field and get high. And so she's like, I totally get it.
She could get it.
So, yeah. So she had that. And Cammy had a completely different story, being from Beverly Hills and had only acted on one thing, but she just had this infectious energy that felt so right for the role, and this raw talent that was undeniable. And then so separately they were amazing, but so were a lot of the other actresses. Like I saw so many talented actresses, but then together they were electric.
Did you do the auditions in LA?
I took tapes first and then came here to do chemistry reads.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. The movie has like a super, even though it's like crazy and there's a lot of like plot, like it feels super natural, right? It's like kind of naturalistic and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Was it everything they say is like scripted? Like,
yeah.
Pretty specific. Like, there's not a lot of improvising in it?
Not much. Mm-mm. Not much. It's all very, I mean, I spent like a long time working on the scripts, but yeah, it's all very scripted. But I just feel like, it's not, I mean, they didn't have to be precise with the words. If it was like, oh, it's so hot outside, they could be like, goddamn, I'm fucking hot. You know, they could say whatever they wanted to say, but within the scripts. And not a ton changed. I think the only big thing that changed was there were no bros in the script. And then like the finished film was like a lot of them like, what's, you know, bro, like this, bro, that. I remember one time I was like,
oh, the word bro.
Yeah. I was like, we've reached our limit on bros and fucks. So
what about dudes though? There's a lot of dudes.
There's a bunch of dudes in the script. Yeah. So, but yeah, I think there were additional dudes that just come out. It's like one of those things that happens when you're improvising.
Well, and a little gift too, right? Like the actors then know like, okay, this is the vernacular. This is how a character maybe fills time or like thinks through something or something.
That's totally interesting.
There's this scene in the movie where they're in the grocery store and like some older guy sees one of them eating nuts right for free, like grazing at the nut bar. And he tells her she's like stealing from the store, and she goes in on this diatribe about how, I don't know, he has a small penis or something. I forget what it's about, but it's a really long rant.
His head is probably the closest thing to a penis on his filthy, rotting, sagging body.
Right. How? So was that scripted?
Yeah, that was scripted, and that was actually her audition scene, and just nailed it. And then she came in that day and just did it over and over and just like kept bringing it. She's so fantastic.
So I know we're running out of time, but I just want to ask you real quick about the movie. So you have these two actresses, like young actresses, and they're doing crazy things. They're getting high. They're like almost making out. They're stealing things. They're cursing at everyone. Everything they do is like pretty much illegal. Is it hard? Like, do you have to talk to their parents? Or like, are you ever nervous about having to tell these young actors to do all this stuff? Or how does that work?
No, because Maya's 24. Five now, so she was like 24 or something at the time, and you know, has been working for years. She's like a grown person who decides those things on her own. Yeah, she's an adult. And Cammie was, she was younger. I think she was 20 when we were shooting. No, I mean, they had read the script. We had conversations ahead of time. I think Cammie's one hesitation was the scene in the closet. Like, and she talks about it now. She's like, I didn't think I could do it. And so I told my agents, I don't think I can do this. And they're like, you're doing it. She's like, but I'm scared. They're like, that's why.
Well, before we wrap things up, I'd love to talk about the differences between the first, the trial run, right? Mm-hmm. And the finished movie. Like, what did you decide to do differently? From a directing perspective, from a craft perspective, were there any kind of big philosophical shifts?
Yeah, there were two big choices that I made going into the second one. The first choice was not working from a place of fear. And so I found myself doing that a lot of times in the first draft or the first version of the script, being afraid and not knowing what I could say and what I couldn't say and how far I could push things and just not having the confidence because I'd never really written or made something, you know, feature length and really relying on the people around me to be like, I think that's a little too much, or you need this plot device or this or that. And so kind of listening to people who didn't have the similar instinct or vibe or, you know, vision that I had and trusting them when I shouldn't have. I should have just trusted my instinct and like gone with that. And then, oh, from the time that I made the first one to the second one, I saw Broad City. And mm-hmm. so that was huge to me. I was like, what? They're doing like poop jokes? I wanted to do poop jokes and I was too scared to do poop jokes. I'm fucking putting these into my movie because I find them funny and they make me laugh and I want to do things that make me laugh. Mm-hmm. And make me fulfilled. And so that was a big thing. And then also, you know, the falling apart thing that I mentioned earlier, I didn't want that. I never wanted a guy to come in and be an obstacle. I thought it was so true. Like, try it. You see it in every film. Mm-hmm. I didn't want that. So I was like, it's not going to happen. If there are obstacles, it's coming from outside and they're going to approach it together. So they need mm-hmm. like any sort of, I mean, you need an obstacle to like make a movie. And so it has to be an outside obstacle. So it was that. And then as far as shooting style went.
You're talking about the script writing.
Yeah, script
not
writing.
Not the crew.
No. but yeah, then the making of it, I hired everyone by listening and trusting my gut instinct, which was more important than anything that they'd done and more important than
their real resume.
Yeah, it was about like, do we get along? Do you see things eye to eye? Can we riff on movies and like have the same influences and the same, you know, reference movies? And are you an asshole? Like, if you're not an asshole and we have all these things, then you're hired. And so that was the thing. And then as far as planning shots went, that was one time when I had a very extensive list of reference shots. And so it wasn't even just like, hey, I've envisioned this thing. Like, it would kind of go like this. It was like, hey, this is a shot from The Big Lebowski. I want to copy it exactly for this scene. And so I did that.
Yeah,
like, and so I pulled a ton of shots like that. My DP and I sat together and just for like 2 or 3 weeks when she came to town, we would spend every day just walking through things and plotting it out because we knew we only had this many days and this much mm-hmm. money. And so everything was very well planned and very well plotted.
That's cool. Awesome. Did you have any shooting philosophy? Like, were like, did you shoot coverage? Like, is there anything
that was
part of your plan?
I love coverage. If we have time, we get as much coverage as we can. I never turn down a shot. Like, if I'm like, okay, I think we're good here, and she's like, I think we might need, I'm like, let's get it then.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes you're just like, no, I think we're good, and then I'm remembering, no, my rule is like, always get the coverage. And so, and then, you know, you get the coverage and trust the people around you,
yeah.
Especially my DP, Greta Zozula, who is fantastic and so brilliant.
That's awesome. Do you have, just because you're in the thick of it, do you have any tips on being interviewed about your movie? Like, is there anything you've kind of learned over the last
about
few weeks about
being interviewed?
Yeah. Like, do you try to give a different answer every time you get asked the same question or anything?
Sometimes.
Like that?
It kind of depends. Sometimes I just kind of say the thing. I try and do it a little bit different. I think what I find with press is having seen my husband been through this whole process a number of times, I just remember on his press, he goes, you know, to do press in various cities and he's traveling and I'm like, you're so lucky, like you get to go do press and like you're being flown to these cities. And he's like, I'm literally there for like 10 hours and then I'm on a plane to the next place. Right. And you're saying the same thing all day, every day. It's the worst. I fucking hate it. I'm like, yeah, but you made a movie and it's lucky and blah, blah, blah. And so when I like, my first press experience, he's like, see? And I'm like, yes, it kind of sucks, but it's amazing. Like, I can't believe that I'm being taken and people care and they want to hear what I have to say. And I get to talk about this thing that I made. And yes, it sucks. And yes, you're tired. And I'm losing my voice. And you're saying the same thing all day. But there are sometimes are new questions and they're like interesting aspects. So I just try and feel grateful for like, man, you guys, I made a movie.
There you go.
A24 is releasing my movie. People are going to see it. It's going to be in theaters.
Where did it
this
premiere?
Is a fucking privilege at Sundance.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Heard
yeah.
of it.
It's, you know that one? It's like Robert. I mean, yeah, sure. talk to him.
Yeah.
they call him Bob. I don't know. Yeah.
Bobby Red.
I messed up my joke. You're right.
God damn it. Yeah. Yeah. You were supposed to name drop Robert. Yeah. You have to call him Bob if you do.
Yeah. There we go.
Cool. Well, that's awesome. Yeah. I find like when you do Q&As, like on your same movie at festivals, you get better at them every
you
time.
You find oh, your yeah. stories.
And yeah, you find out like, yeah. oh, people love this story. And yeah, yeah. you kind of get bored by this one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I definitely tell some of the same anecdotes throughout yeah. Q&As because. Q&As are way worse than press. Like, I mean, it's terrifying. I have horrible stage fright and I get diarrhea of the mouth and I just start talking and I say a lot of things I probably shouldn't say. And so I did. Thank you. That's what everyone's like, no, you're so good at Q&As. I'm like, you don't know what I'm feeling inside. It's so crushing and I'm embarrassed and sad and like depressed. Like, I'm doing my best.
Well, I feel like I still have a zillion questions about the movie, love, but we have no time. Can we squeeze our unpaid endorsement section in here?
Unpaid endorsements.
You got anything, Matt?
Yes, I do. I'm watching Succession. Are you guys watching? No one's talking about that show. It's so good.
Okay.
It's like
what channel is it on?
It's on HBO. It's like unfunny Arrested Development. Basically, it's like this crazy like family that's basically like your Sumner Redstone-y sort of power hierarchy where it's like the patriarch and then like the kids are all kind of feuding with each other to basically take over the company and he's still trying to like hold on to all of his power and so it's like really like Shakespearean.
It's like Game of Thrones.
It's like
in the corporate world.
I mean kind of yeah and the performances are all awesome. The whole ensemble is really great. And it's shot really well. And it's still like darkly funny. It's an Adam McKay show. So
I love Adam McKay.
It's so crazy and weird. Yeah, so that's my recommendation. Oh, Succession.
Cool. I'll check it out.
Yeah, Augustine, you got anything?
I've been so in the work mode that I haven't done much. I've seen a few movies. I'm reading a book about Catherine the Great.
Sure.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's pretty fascinating. You know, there's like this new Catherine the Great show. I don't know if you guys saw that.
No.
They just announced. It's on HBO. Do you know about the show? I don't know. But it's a book about her life, and it's fascinating. I never thought she was so interesting. I never knew anything about her. So I'm reading that. That's
what's
really
it
good
called?
Book. It's called Catherine the Great.
Oh, cool.
And it's by a well-known author who does a lot of biographies.
Walter Isaacson? That's the only biographer I know.
I don't know. I'm horrible with names.
We'll drop it in the show notes, though. We'll figure it out. Yeah.
Cool.
Well, or
yeah. So I think this is an obvious thing to anyone that does like any graphic design, but I just want to promote that if you ever have to choose a font and you're having trouble choosing a font and you have a choice between a professional font and something on defont.com or something, like go with the professional font because having like, I'm working on something right now where it's like you have like the bold version, the condensed version, and the light version, and the italic. So just when you're thinking about fonts, trying to find some professional fonts. There's some good ones out there.
You might notice that episode number on our thumbnails is a different font than our main titles, and it's because it's a DeFont font.
Yeah. I love DeFont, like if you're making like bad art for like the art department in a movie.
Sure. Right. Yeah.
Or your podcast art, I guess.
Or your podcast art. No, it's cool, but professional fonts are cooler. Cool. Well, Augustine. If we want to find out more about, does the movie have a Twitter account or social media or anything?
It does. It has all that. The film's called Never Going Back. And so you can find us on Twitter and Instagram and a very own website, Never Going Back Movie or Film or something like that.com.
And we're on the G-O-I-N.
G-O-I-N, yeah. And we're on the A24 website. The A24 website will link you to all of our additional sites. Cool. Yeah.
And what about you?
I have an Instagram. As of yesterday, I'm no longer on Twitter.
Ooh, congratulations.
It was more for like, it's about... anxiety,
yeah.
And around the release of a film, there's just too much, and there's just too much negativity, and I just couldn't be with it. But like the counter of that is all the positivity that I'm also addicted to.
Sure.
I don't need to see any of it. It's unhealthy. And so I just asked to be taken off the press releases and the press responses. I don't want to know. I don't even want to know the good stuff.
Cool.
I just want to live in my bubble for a minute.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, if you want to find out more, if you have any questions or comments about this episode, you can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, everywhere. We're Just Shoot It Pod. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Smitey Pyleg.
And I'm at Mr. Matt. This episode was edited by Jay McCullough. Our show producer is Madeline Rosewatt. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And the music you're listening to right now was provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar.
Leave us an iTunes review if you get a chance. And we will catch you next time.
Awesome. Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.